Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kodalska. And we have a great show in store today. A new survey shows the vast majority of Wyomingites believe climate change is happening.
What's interesting, though, is that they might see it as less of a now problem and more of a future problem.
And we'll spend a day with the Albany County Outdoor School, a program that brings local fourth graders into their public lands.
Our hope is that all of the kids that we work with will grow up to be invested in their public lands and interested in being environmental stewards.
And we will hear a tribute to a Northern Arapaho elder who was fluent in the language.
She was a loving person. She was kind. She was graceful.
Those stories and more, stay with us. This is Open Spaces.
Wyoming Public Media is providing Wyoming and Western wildfire updates on air and now online. Go to wyomingpublicmedia.org and click on Wyoming Wildfire Info. You'll find links to the latest updates on fires around the region, along with information on current air quality conditions, fire restrictions, information on protecting your property, and more. Find it all in one place at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kodalska. 45 bills seeking to rewrite the way Wyoming runs elections were introduced to the last legislative session. About half of them died as the session wrapped up. A few would have banned ballot drop boxes and voting equipment to crack down on fraud that local officials say is not happening. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Chris Clements reports, lawmakers are looking into resurrecting some of those bills anyway.
In a log cabin hotel in Lander, state lawmakers of all stripes are rubbing shoulders and sipping seltzer before an interim elections committee meets the next day. County clerks will demonstrate voting equipment to the public and to electeds, something State Senator Cale Case hopes will show just how secure Wyoming's elections really are.
The facts about documented election fraud, it's almost non-existent.
The Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank, lists four documented cases of voter fraud in Wyoming since 1982, all U.S. citizens who were convicted of a crime. And yet the committee, which Case co-chairs, received 34 pages of topics the public wants bills on. The biggest percentage of them were about election reform. Everything from wanting to hand count ballots and ban tabulating machines, all for security and transparency. That desire for change is striking to Case, since President Trump and the Wyoming Freedom Caucus won big in the last cycle.
And if the same elections produce a particular caucus to get into power for the first time, a huge victory for them, how can we say that the elections, does any one person think their own election is rigged? Never.
Besides an investigation into ballot misprints in Weston County, Case says he hasn't heard much about irregularities or rigged elections in the last cycle. And neither has Gail Simmons, who runs a Wyoming civics website. She says she plans to testify against more election overhaul bills.
The fact that there were 45 elections bills, I'm not going to say it infuriates me. I find it very frustrating because two-thirds of them were to address problems that don't exist.
The next morning, members of the committee take their seats in a room full to the brim with election skeptics and supporters alike. Fremont County Clerk Julie Freese goes step by step through Election Day procedures as someone feeds paper ballots into hulking black and gray tabulating machines.
The representatives will watch and confirm as the county clerk or staff reads the expected results to the test deck.
Freese explains ballot chain of custody as they go from voters' hands to the machines to USB memory sticks to county election headquarters. No part of the process involves connection to the internet. The mock vote she's demonstrating is based on favorite animals.
Cat 8, chicken 7, gerbil 5, horse 4, tarantula 3, write-in 6, overvotes 4, undervotes 9, contest total 46.
No dogs.
No dogs.
There's something wrong with this election.
Then lawmakers on the committee fill out ballots for their own favorite pets.
Your number changed up here.
Okay.
You're good. It took it.
But in the hallway during a break, Representative Nina Weber, a Freedom Caucus endorsee, says while she appreciates the demonstration, it didn't change her mind.
The real questions have to do with what about inside of the machine and programming the machine, and can we get in there and take the machines apart, and are there any modems that can be attached?
When the committee gavels back in, it's clear Weber isn't the only one left doubting. Another caucus endorsee, Representative Joe Webb, motions for the group to study 10 election bills. They died in the last session and could make a reappearance next year.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, aye. No. All right, we will move those forward.
I'm Representative Knapp, and I'm chairman of the Corporations Committee.
Knapp leads the House side of the committee. He's also a leader in the Freedom Caucus. He says the reason freshman lawmakers like Webb and Weber want to pass election reform comes down to what they heard while knocking on voters' doors.
They were fresh off of going door to door, right? Election integrity for that specific year was off the charts.
He disagrees with critics who say many of these bills will disproportionately suppress women, young people, and Hispanic voters from casting ballots.
It's my job to make sure that everybody that can vote, and that we don't impede that, that we make it as easy as possible, but don't cancel their vote out by allowing it to be so easy that fraud can take place.
He says even the possibility of voter fraud is enough to merit another pass at reshaping policy.
I can't say that there's massive fraud in Wyoming. I can't say that there's no fraud in Wyoming. All I can say is that the clerks do an excellent job.
Knapp voted alongside most of the committee to study draft bills this interim that would ban ballot drop boxes, restrict independent candidates, and make it harder to vote with a student ID. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Chris Clements in Lander.
The Trump administration has indicated it would like to sell federal public lands to develop housing, saying it could help address the nation's housing crisis. But it's not a new proposal. Both Democrats and Republicans have floated the idea on the campaign trail. And some regions have explored selling parcels of public lands located within towns or leasing them. A new study from the nonpartisan land management group Headwaters Economics says in the West, federal public lands aren't the most suitable for housing and may even present safety and logistical challenges for developers. Rocky Mountain Community Radio's Caroline Yanez spoke with Megan Lawson, one of the economists that worked on that study.
Yeah, so tell me a little bit about the study that Headwaters did. Where were you looking and what data did you guys look at?
Because it was a national analysis, we had to simplify some things. So we just looked at Bureau of Land Management and Forest Service administrative parcels that are really close to communities. So either adjacent to, within, or within a quarter mile of communities that have historically not been building enough housing. They have unmet housing needs, which is so many of our communities in the West. And so we really wanted to focus on those parcels that are closest to communities, those public land parcels, because if a builder has to extend infrastructure like roads and electricity and drinking water and wastewater, if they have to extend that far outside of town, whatever housing that gets built will be really expensive, just because of the cost of infrastructure will be so expensive. But because we had to make some simplifying assumptions because of the scale of this analysis, I think it's an overestimate of the buildable land, because things that we were not able to consider: water availability, topography, you know, a lot of these places are steep and rugged. We were not able to consider other important uses of those public lands already, like wildlife habitat, endangered species protection, oil and gas leases that may already be on these properties, recreational leases like trails that may already be in those areas. So we cast a pretty broad net in terms of the types of land that we considered possible.
And what were some of the big takeaways from this study?
So the first thing that we found is that the amount of public land, amount of federal land that is available near these communities is really pretty limited. And it's about 2% of public lands that we looked at. But when we dug into that a little bit, one thing that Headwaters Economics really keeps a close eye on is wildfire exposure for communities. And we found that about half of that land faces really high wildfire risk. And so we want to be sure when we're building new housing that we're not putting more people in harm's way. We also found that, you know, overall, looking across the country, that we could possibly build about 700,000 homes on public lands adjacent to communities, but that's very focused in just in a handful of states: Nevada, Arizona, California, New Mexico, and Utah. And so the number of homes that could be built and could be built safely without putting people in harm's way is pretty small compared to overall the need for housing.
So something that I thought was really interesting was the tools and policy recommendations that you guys make as it relates to public lands and housing. Tell me a little bit more about those.
I think the most important thing to remember is that public land development really should be strategic and safeguarded. We have to make sure that we're protecting the value of this asset for all Americans. And so that if housing is being built on public lands, that we have tools to make sure that that housing is permanently affordable. So it improves housing affordability in our communities. We need to make sure that we're looking first at infill, which is building housing within the footprint of our existing communities. So whether that's maybe a public land parcel within our community or it's an undeveloped private parcel, those things will help to minimize infrastructure costs, because a lot of homes could be built on land that's already available when we focus on density and infrastructure investments. I think another tool that we need to keep in mind with the Forest Service: current authorization allows them to lease the land rather than selling it. And I think leasing public lands is a better way to preserve their long-term value rather than selling them outright. Another policy that, again, we think about a lot and do a lot of research on is resilient building standards and making sure that any homes that we're building in a wildfire zone are hardened against the risk of wildfire.
So how does this conversation fit into the bigger picture we're seeing today, especially as the Trump administration targets public lands, some for sale, especially out here in the West?
There's been a lot of conversation around selling off public lands to build housing and selling off public lands to balance the budget. But if we are selling off public lands at the market rate, auctioning it off to the highest bidder, we're going to be auctioning off high value lands that's going to cost a lot. And just by definition, those lands are not going to be affordable. We're not going to be able to build affordable housing. And so that will really be a sell-off to benefit a small number of people who are able to afford that higher end, more luxury housing. It is not going to help housing affordability in our gateway public lands communities. If anything, it's going to make it worse, contribute to the rising cost of living. The second thing that I think about when we're talking about selling off public lands for any reason is I think it overlooks how much our Western gateway communities depend on those public lands for their economy and for their economic well-being in so many ways, whether it's resource extraction, oil, gas, mining, whether it's agriculture, whether it's outdoor recreation. You know, so many communities have really built up around this. And they've also invested a lot of private sector investment in, you know, say a guiding business that takes folks out, you know, hiking on trails near a community. That business depends on those public lands being well-maintained, those trails being well-maintained, and being able to access them. And so I'm really concerned that if selling public lands really continues to get momentum, that will have a really negative impact on these smaller communities, especially these rural places that have invested everything in their economic development around outdoor recreation on public lands.
That was Megan Lawson of Headwaters Economics speaking with reporter Caroline Yanez. This report was shared with us via Rocky Mountain Community Radio, a network of public media stations in Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, and New Mexico. Up next on Open Spaces, we stay on public lands as fourth graders learn about the outdoors. Stay with us.
As a listener to Wyoming Public Radio, you know that a significant portion of our news coverage is dedicated to local stories. We're committed to keeping you informed about what's happening right here in our communities. From city council meetings to neighborhood initiatives, we're here to show you the local impact of national events and the national scope of local issues. Support from our local community allows us to maintain this vital local focus, bringing you stories that matter most to you and your neighbors. So why does your support matter? Because in an era of shrinking local news coverage, Wyoming Public Media remains committed to telling our community's stories. Your membership ensures we can keep our reporters on the ground, uncovering the stories that shape our daily lives. So, join us as a monthly member today. It's quick and easy, and you'll be playing a crucial role in sustaining quality local journalism. Call us during our upcoming pledge drive or visit wyomingpublicmedia.org to start your membership today. Together, we can keep our community informed, engaged, and thriving.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. The Albany County Outdoor School brought local fourth graders to Kurt Gowdy State Park recently, where they learned about science and outdoor recreation. Wyoming Public Radio's Indy Kara spent the day with them.
The day started bright and early, with heavy spring rain and some school bus mechanical issues that left students briefly stuck on the side of the highway. But that didn't get them down. And soon, about 50 fourth graders from Laramie's Linford Elementary School poured into Hines Lodge at Kurt Gowdy. The Albany County Outdoor School is run by the nonprofit Common Outdoor Ground, which places volunteers in public lands. Nicole Foss is its director. She says fourth and fifth graders used to take an annual trip to Teton Science Schools near Jackson, where they'd learn about the environment and outdoor skills. But the bus ride was long, parents and teachers were working full-time, plus going on this trip, and families had to raise thousands of dollars themselves. Common Outdoor Ground started thinking about ways to recreate the experience locally with the money it already had.
We have unparalleled access to public lands. We have many expert instructors at the university. We have a lot of people who are really enthusiastic and really engaged in early childhood education and K through 12 education.
And so Outdoor School was born last year. Sessions happen each fall and spring, supported by grants. It's free for students. Schools also don't have to pay for it, but they do just need to provide a bus for transport. Each session is 2 days. The first is focused on science standards. The team works closely with teachers beforehand to learn what content they should cover.
It's like a great reminder of, oh yeah, we talked about animal adaptations in class, but now we get to see it with these tracks in the wild or with these pelts from this trunk.
And the second is focused on outdoor recreation, like what to pack in a day pack and how to find local public land. The yellow group, identified by bright yellow bandanas, started out at the soil station. Some students had brought soil from home to analyze. Others scooped it from large buckets. They mixed it with water, making a thick slurry.
Yeah, I think I'm gonna take a little bite.
Students ran tests for pH and nitrogen levels. They jotted numbers in notebooks they had decorated with stickers earlier in the morning. And when the yellow group set off on a hike with naturalist Katie Wynn, clad in ponchos, they were on the lookout for new experiences.
So who wants to be the brave soul who smells the first rock? You? Okay, so you can lead us and you can pick a rock to smell. Did you smell it?
Ooh, that's
different smell.
What's it smell like?
Grossness.
Like water. It does not smell
like raw dirt.
Water.
After lunch, one group looked at skulls and pelts from the Wyoming State Museum. The station was originally supposed to be birding, but plans had to change given the rain. They tried to identify a wide, flat, brown pelt sprawled on the table. Guesses ranged from local animals to ones that aren't even in Wyoming.
Stingray.
A stingray?
Yeah.
Do stingrays have hair?
No, they don't.
Oh, no. It looks like one, though.
Instructor Hannah Smith of Game and Fish quickly informed us that it was, in fact, a beaver, not a stingray. The conversation moved to why animals have summer and winter coats.
What is it called when an animal blends in?
Camouflage.
Why would an animal want to be camouflaged?
I have something right here.
Gentlemen?
Not be dead.
To not die. Yes, why would
For the yellow group, the day wrapped up at the geology station, where students learned all things erosion with instructor Andrew Miller.
What do you notice? Are the rocks smooth? Are they sharp? Are they big? Are they heavy? Are they fragile? Are they strong?
They're crunchy.
They're crunchy.
At the end of the day, fourth grader Bodie said the coolest thing he learned was...
like the breakdown of rocks can be chemical and physical.
And his favorite activity was making beaver dams in a session about environmental engineering. The kids spent day two in the snowy range. According to director Nicole Foss, only a third of last year's students had even been there before.
Our hope is that all of the kids that we work with will grow up to be invested in their public lands and interested in being environmental stewards. You just can't have engaged environmental stewards unless you have positive experiences with the environment, especially at a young age.
Foss says a long-term goal would be for every school in Albany County to access days like this, to connect with land that's right in their backyard.
We all own this land together. We should all be invested in taking care of it. And a big part of getting to the point where you know how to take care of your public land is getting out there and experiencing the joys and benefits of it.
Three public elementary schools have participated in the program so far, but there are plans in the works to expand. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Indy Kara.
A recent University of Wyoming survey of Wyomingites found about 86% believe climate change is happening. Of course, there's a lot of nuance wrapped up in that, like differing thoughts on what's causing these changes and just how bad they'll be. But still, that 86% might be surprising if you've followed state politics, where some lawmakers have denied climate science. Wyoming Public Radio's Caitlin Tan interviewed Kristen Landreville. She's the lead researcher of the new study looking at water, climate, and Wyomingites.
So, Kristen, why should people trust this study or feel like it represents Wyoming?
The survey is representative. And so what that means is that we have the same type of distribution in our sample in terms of demographics, like age. Every county is represented, as well as biological sex. So we have these demographic variables that reflect the Wyoming total population. So we can say that with our results, that these 500 people can represent the entire state.
So let's get into the kind of meat of the study. It seems like where most Wyomingites had common ground about climate change is with water. The vast majority say the state is susceptible to changes in water resources. What does that mean?
We know that weather and water really shape our daily experiences. What's interesting, though, is that they might see it as less of a now problem and more of a future problem. We do see some differences slightly by region. So, for example, we know that the city of Rawlins has had some issues with water infrastructure, with drought then exacerbating those water infrastructure problems. And more people said, yes, we're feeling the effects of these water changes compared to people in the northwest part of the state where they have more water resources in general.
There wasn't agreement on why climate change is happening. About half said they believe it's not human caused. And that's despite most research and scientists saying otherwise. Anything more you can share with those details for us?
We do know that some of these issues with causal attribution could relate to trust. So trust in who you see as your opinion leader, who you see as in your in-group. And so it could be a difference in if they're trusting maybe climate scientists more than they trust their lawmakers.
So Kristen, what are kind of the next steps? Based on the people that you surveyed, it seemed like the majority would like to see changes or some kind of action.
I think that's one of the key results from the survey. About 75% of people want state lawmakers to do more to address the changing water resources in the state. People were supportive of a small financial incentive to homes that use less water, requiring K-12 teachers to discuss water, teach about its impacts on the state. And then another idea was to pay water rights holders in the state for more efficient water operations. And lots of people think that these costs are worth it. So people recognize that these policies are going to cost money to implement. And then I also want to talk about this idea of local community action too. So we found that, again, 75% of people see water changes happening, but they said that only 30% of people in their community thought the same thing. And so when you get that gap, it can create this fear of not knowing what other people think. You think they disagree with you, so you're afraid to speak out or you don't feel comfortable talking about these issues in your community.
Stepping back to what you were talking about with people hoping to see policy changes, you know, do you think that's realistic based on who has been voted into office? Wyoming's Freedom Caucus members, this especially this session and the last, have touted a lot of climate change denial. Some saying we don't need to reduce climate warming emissions or attributing melting glaciers to reasons other than climate change. On a federal level, we are seeing climate change research disappear after President Trump took office. So I guess I want to know if it's actually realistic to see policy changes when quite a few lawmakers don't seem to believe in climate change at this point.
Yeah, I think when people go into the voting booth, they're not necessarily voting on climate change issues. They could be voting on things like security or the economy, but that doesn't mean that they agree with their people they elect 100% of the time. So I think it'd be a mistake of lawmakers to just assume that their people who voted them in think exactly the same with them on every single issue. So anyone who has power in this government, you know, we need to think about this survey and what it's showing us. What Wyoming people are saying, that there are changes going on and they want to plan for them.
Now, Kristen, it sounds like obviously this was really important research to you and your team. This was partly funded by the National Science Foundation, which has recently been on the chopping block by the Trump administration. NPR reports that hundreds of previously approved NSF grants aren't going through, and the agency could see billions in budget cuts. Do you have any concerns about research going forward?
I do. I am concerned. Federal funding is not easily replaced. Having said that, though, I do think that there are opportunities for nonprofit groups, private foundations, corporations to step up. But I don't know if it could fill the potential federal funding gap that could occur.
Would you guys have been able to do your research to the extent that you did without the NSF grant?
Well, the National Science Foundation fully funded my work with the survey. So I don't think that this survey would have happened without the support.
Well, we've been speaking today with University of Wyoming researcher Kristen Landreville. She led the survey looking at Wyomingites' thoughts on climate change and water. And if you want to see more about that research, there's a really great interactive website where you can really dig deep into the data, and it's very user-friendly. We'll post a link to that on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Coming up, we'll hear how shelters are in need in parts of our region. This is Open Spaces.
This time on The Modern West. It's been a year since a man brought an injured wolf into a bar in Sublette County. What does it tell us about how small-town life is changing?
Boys and boobs and wolves obviously didn't mix up well, all right? What was wrong about it was bringing it to this damn bar.
Boys, booze, and wolves. It's part three of The Gray in Between. Find it under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio. I'm Camila Kadalska. 2 years ago, the murder of a pregnant woman in Victor, Idaho, shocked the Teton community. After that, the number of people seeking refuge at a local domestic violence shelter surged. Now, this small community west of the Tetons is running out of places to put people seeking emergency shelter and midterm supportive housing. Jackson Hole Community Radio's Sophia Boyd-Fliegel reports.
Frida Montalvo never saw relationships escalate to violence, but as a teenager, the 20-year-old first started noticing some of her friends were in relationships that made her uncomfortable. One night hanging out with friends when she was 17, she saw somebody who was her age and not sober with another person who she says was being very touchy.
It was in that moment when I knew that if it escalated to more, it could be a very dangerous situation for that person to be in.
Montalvo usually finds it easy to speak her mind. This time, she found she was missing the language to describe what she was seeing. So she signed up for an internship with Family Safety Network, a nonprofit in Driggs, Idaho, that advocates for healthy relationships while supporting people who've experienced domestic and sexual violence. She learned how to talk openly about unhealthy relationships.
And that is very important when those things are happening, is for people to look, to not turn the other way. One of the things that perpetrators do, they do it because they know they can get away with it if nobody is looking.
She now sits on the board of the organization, and she was in Victor in December 2023 when Callie Jean Randall, the pregnant mother of a 10-month-old, was murdered by her husband in her Victor home. Jeremy Albert Best pled guilty to 3 counts of murder in February. After news broke of Randall's death, the Family Safety Network saw a surge in people seeking shelter. It hasn't slowed, according to Emily Belcher, who leads the organization.
23, like you can really like go to that month and see this like exponential growth.
In 2022, the number of nights that people, including children, spent in shelter was about 150. The shelter world calls these bed nights. Then, after Randall's murder, that number jumped to almost 1,800, a jump of over 1,000%. Many instances of abuse go unreported, and it appears that shelter growth has far outpaced the reports of sex assault and aggravated assault, respectively up 25 and 40% in the last 2 years, according to the Teton County, Idaho Sheriff's Office.
A wild amount of people came and sought our services because that happened. And we're like, when I saw that this happened, I thought this could be me. Or a friend bringing in a friend saying, when this happened, I called her and said, like, we gotta get you some help. Like, there's resources available.
Since the COVID-19 pandemic, East Idaho's population has ticked up while home prices have soared. That means less affordable places to stay. 10 years ago, Bilcher says, people spent up to 5 nights in emergency shelter and less than a month in transitional housing. Now, she says, people are often in emergency shelter for up to 3 months and taking about a year to move out of transitional housing. The Safety Network's office in Driggs serves many needs.
Laundry utility closet. And then this was a garage, and we used to have a thrift store here.
They're trying to raise $200,000 this summer to double their capacity for emergency shelter. As it stands, survivors and their families can stay in one apartment or one standalone three-bedroom home. Last year, the organization spent over $9,000 putting people up in hotel rooms when they didn't have enough space. Before the end of the year, they want to build another studio home for emergency nights, with the aim of adding another one-bedroom apartment for transitional housing in 2026. Over the pass in Teton County, Wyoming, the Community Safety Network is a similar organization and an example of what could be.
This metal one, you'd walk into like an open concept living room and kitchen.
Tricycles and toys sit in a sunny courtyard. Wrapped around it is a 7-bed, 5-bath house that provides emergency shelter for about 15 people, with access to food, toiletries, and a cozy communal space that's just feet away from 6 other apartments where people can stay up to 2 years working on life skills, like budgeting and healing from violence, so they can live independently. Similar to their counterparts in Idaho, the Jackson-based organization saw a surge in awareness and need when the COVID-19 pandemic added pressure to relationships. Shannon Brooks-Hamby leads the organization. Yeah,
so last year was our highest number of clients served to date.
Their shelter, built in the mid-90s, has been key to providing the 2,400 bed nights they saw last year. Still, they occasionally run out of space on site, according to Director of Client Services, Rosa Sanchez. But even if campus is full, they don't want to turn anyone away.
We have to get creative with our spaces, and we do also partner with hotels in the area.
Keeping people on a campus, Sanchez says, is not only important for their safety, but essential to healing.
Nobody really wants to be here, right? No one wants to be in a situation that is going to force them to have to seek out this type of service. But if you are, how can we be intentional about those spaces to make it so that people feel comfortable, not ashamed?
Brooks-Hamby, who lives in Victor, says that without safe housing, people often endure more abuse.
Housing is such a critical, if not the most critical, factor in leaving an abusive situation. Many, many people stay in situations that are unsafe because of lack of housing.
More bedrooms would give Family Safety Network more space for education to change the culture of violence and its bystanders. Montalvo says this education was what made her braver.
This fight is all of our fight, and it requires all of us to be present.
For some, being present starts with just a place to safely be.
More confidence.
Sophia Boyd-Fliegel, KHOL News.
A new exhibit highlighting pop art about the American West is going up at the Center for the West in Cody. That's up next on Open Spaces.
Can't have the radio on all day, but want to keep up to date with Wyoming news? Then check out our new daily podcast, The Wyoming Debrief. Get daily news around Wyoming and test your knowledge of the cowboy state with some trivia. All of that in under 10 minutes. Find Wyoming Debrief wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. Northern Arapaho Elder Marion Scott was one of less than 100 fluent speakers of the language. and she spent her life working to keep it alive and flourishing. She taught at Wyoming Indian Elementary School for almost 3 decades and stayed involved in the schools and language preservation efforts long after her retirement. Scott was a regular at powwows, community events, and basketball games.
Everybody called her Nawa, which is grandma, which is my grandma, you know, when you're talking to your personal grandma.
Scott passed away at the age of 80 this spring. Her fellow educators at Wyoming Indian Schools shared their stories about Scott's light and legacy. We first hear from Elena Singer, the director of the Language and Culture Department at Wyoming Indian Schools.
I could always go to Marion and ask her to translate materials or whatever it was. And she was always more than willing. And we were all really fortunate to have her right there in the building with us. She made our school a place where kids felt like they belonged because they had an AWA, our grandma. You'd see her like talking to kids. Kids would go to her for a hug. They could see her in the hallway, and just seeing her in the hallway brought comfort to a lot of our students, you know, because she was a loving person. She was kind and she was graceful. I mean, if you ever were around her, you got that sense from her. She'd come in. We have monthly translation meetings where we invite them in and they work with our teachers. It's just wonderful to hear them when they get together and they talk, and they're talking in Arapaho and they're laughing, and it's a beautiful sound. And we're all listening with our whole beings, trying to hang on to every word that they're saying so we can keep it going.
I am Evelyn Moore, known Marion most of my life. Growing up, she was always the presence. Her and my mom worked together in 2009. When my mom passed away, she was a big presence in our lives. You know, she came to be with us. After my mom passed, I was offered my mom's job. So I had the opportunity to teach alongside Marion. It was the most dream job, being able to work alongside somebody who was a fluent speaker. Even after she retired, she continued to work tirelessly for the Arapaho language. She felt it was important for all of our kids and anybody who wants to learn, you know. So she started helping other school districts around the reservation.
I'm Ray Yumchi. I knew Marion basically my whole life because my mom is Ava. And when I became a teacher after I took over on my mom's job, it was real surprising because a couple weeks after I started in on my job, she seen me and she said, "Hey, how come you didn't tell me you were teaching?" And I said, "Oh yeah, I am." She said, "I know. My grandkids come home and tell me what you teach." She said, "You're good." She's like, "Keep it up." You know, that really made me feel good about myself, because coming from a teacher like her, you know, that says a lot.
My name is Patricia Goggles. Marion and I were in a program called the Master Apprentice, and she was my master speaker and I was her apprentice. She was a kind of a mentor at the school for me personally, because I started working in the school in 2000 and she was already there. I have known her for being a fluent speaker, for being a mom, a grandmother, and just somebody that our community could depend on. She was very powerful presence, and she will be missed. I'm sorry, I can't hardly talk about her without, kind of left a big, great big blow to our language. She meant a lot to our whole reservation, our whole community. And I guess one of the best things that we can do to honor her memory is to encourage our young people to learn our language. The work that she has done with her life is really, really important. And if we can do half of what she's done to impact our community, we would be in a good place, you know. She impacted so many lives. It's going to be felt for a really long time.
This tribute to Northern Arapaho Elder Marion Scott was produced by Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman. When you think of pop art, Andy Warhol's Campbell soup cans might come to mind, but he also turned his psychedelic palette toward the West. Some of his screen prints of Western subjects are in an exhibition opening at the Buffalo Bill Center of the West this month called Pop Goes the West. One of the exhibit's living artists is originally from Holland. Willem Wolkers rode a scooter through Yellowstone in his teens. That trip made a lasting impact. He went on to share his early impressions of the West and humorous takes on tourism in his art, using paint-by-number images, neon, and found objects. Wyoming Public Radio's Olivia Wheats was there when he and some museum staff installed two of his works in the show.
He makes his own crates out of insulating foam, so they're strong and they're light and they're really easy to open. My name is Susan Barnett. I am the Margaret and Dick Scarlett Curator of Western American Art at the Whitney Western Art Museum. This is kind of the front piece to the show with its bright neon colors. You're going to come down the stairs and you're going to see neon, and it's going to be a wow moment.
When I was in my teens and I started to explore the West, I started to see these neon signs, which were pretty grand in those days. My name is Willem Wolkers. I was born in Holland. I'm an artist. I was trained as a painter, and over time, just, quote-unquote, just painting canvas on a stretcher wasn't enough. I wanted to build work, construct work that would come into the viewer's space.
So I love the title. It's called Dreaming the West, and it is a hand that is created out of neon tubing that seems to be drawing a Western landscape. And so it's, to me, it seems like it's about the creation of Western imagery and Western mythology. There's also kind of a paint-by-number style going on. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, this image right here in Dreaming the West is actually based directly on a paint-by-number painting. And so I started to find those in junk stores. I'd never seen them before. It wasn't part of the Dutch cultural aesthetic of the 50s.
I have my theory about the title of this. Can you talk about why you call this Dreaming the West?
In this case, the dreaming is taking place with a hand actually drawing a landscape and a barn in a Western kind of landscape. So the West that I dreamed of as a kid is sort of becoming a reality through the process of art, through a hand, an artist's hand, drawing the landscape. When I was 13, my parents decided that we were coming to the United States, we're going to emigrate, and of course you start dreaming about the West. My memories when I was a kid of the West were pretty grandiose, probably. I was thinking about cowboys and Indians and tall mountains.
But I had also heard of Yellowstone National Park. But I think that we idealized everything, of course, you know. And indeed, the country was beautiful, but life for us as immigrants was difficult. We were only allowed to take $1,000 per person out of the country. So we started the whole family. The whole family started with like $8,000, you know. I've been working since I was 14 and had to contribute to the family budget. So this little black box is the transformer for this panel here. And the other one has a similar transformer. But you can see how small and light they are.
That will power the neon?
Yeah, that powers the neon.
Okay. Do we have power? That power isn't on, apparently. Yeah.
If a tourist touches this, what will happen to them?
If they what?
If they touch it.
oh, they'll never be back. No. No. It's...
Well, now we're getting ready to hang your other work that's in the show. Yeah, okay. Yellowstone Wildlife, which is it's an image of Old Faithful in neon.
Well, Old Faithful is obviously iconic. It's been heralded by a lot of kind of famous painters, and I'm kind of putting all of that in the more mundane medium of neon and found objects. Yellowstone Wildlife takes me back to first encountering Old Faithful when I was probably 16. I had a motor scooter, a bright red Cushman motor scooter, and I traveled all throughout the West from Seattle exploring. After living in Holland at that point most of my life, I had not seen anything like a geyser. And so seeing that was quite delightful and quite beautiful. I started to accumulate and collect objects that obviously were not Yellowstone souvenirs. It's called Yellowstone Wildlife, but it's obviously not. So that's the fun part of it. You'll see it. Well, there is a swan, and there are a couple of birds and different deer and a couple of bears, and a lady that is wearing a slightly provocative dress, and a bear with a fish in its mouth, and a squirrel. I like people engaging with the piece and saying, oh, I have one of those, or I remember that, or my grandmother had this. As a matter of fact, I often think of these objects that I buy in junk stores of that being somebody's grandmother's, and when she died, they didn't know what to do with it, so let's take it off to the Goodwill, you know. A lot of people would question whether this is wildlife or not. There's dogs in here. There are birds that don't belong in Yellowstone. And so hopefully people will kind of spend a little time looking at the objects and thinking about the title that I gave this piece, Yellowstone Wildlife. Would I find that there? No, probably not. Why are they here? And then all they have to do is think about me as an artist going through junk stores and giving these animals new life and placing them in an environment where they may or may not belong.
That was artist Willem Volkruis sharing his thoughts about his artwork in the Pop Goes the West exhibition. The show opens May 24th. Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. It can also be found wherever you get your podcasts. And we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms. And a thank you to Melody Edwards, our audio producer, Ivy Angle, our digital producer, and Cody Hume, our social media manager. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.